So my father has been in law enforcement my entire life. He went from a military police officer in the Army to a civilian patrolman, then to detective, then to sergeant, then to lieutenant, and well, now he's retired. It was interesting being raised in a law enforcement home. I was taught at an early age how to respond to cops, especially as a white male. I was told to always ask for a lawyer before answering any questions and to make sure, above all else, that they knew my father was a cop. These techniques I have used many times in my life, especially the one about my father being a cop, and they have served me in my white body well. But most of all, at a very early age, I learned that anyone, including myself, who found themselves incarcerated, probably deserved to be there. These learnings were seared into my brain. They are what I believed when I first started serving the incarcerated folks of the Solano County Jail, where I am a volunteer assistant chaplain. Entering the jail with this attitude of us versus them, or criminal versus legal, caused a great deal of disruption in my heart. How was I going to be able to sit in spiritual communion with child molesters, rapists, murderers, and others I had been taught deserve to pay for their crime? Could I do this and still continue to harbor the universalist belief that while they may have deserved punishment, there was something holy even in them? I remember one meeting that I had last year that really affected me deeply. She, let's call her Miss Ashby, entered the Women's Correctional Library where I had been seated earlier by the guard. "Hello, Miss Ashby. My name is Chaplain Lemery. Would you like to have a seat?" I motion to the wooden chair on the other side of the table as she pulls the chair out and sits down. Now, as is my practice, I do not look up the rap sheets of the people who are incarcerated that I serve before or even after I meet with them. I do this because I do not want my own internal biases to alter my ability to be with that person. You would think that after 2 years of volunteering at the Solano County Jail, that I would have been very accustomed to meeting with incarcerated folks, but this meeting was quite different. I was not present to deliver religious reading material, nor reading glasses, nor to hear a grievance. These are my normal tasks as a jail chaplain. Instead, I say, "Miss Ashby, I'm so sorry to inform you that yesterday your grandmother died." She begins to cry hard, sobbing uncontrollably. I feel the desire to reach out and hold her as she wrestles with the feelings, but I am not permitted to have physical contact with the inmates. So I acknowledge the feeling that I'm having and I breathe. Additionally, I'm instantly taken to my own grandmother's death in my mind and my sadness there. And my sadness and Miss Ashby's sadness, they collide in what I can only call the holy dance of chaplaincy. I remain silent and I allow the sacred space to settle as we welcome grief into the room. Once the crying subsides, Miss Ashby takes me on a journey of her memories of her grandmother. I'm struck at how close Miss Ashby and her grandmother were. Her grandmother, after all, as she explains, raised her children from a young, early age, as Miss Ashby has been in and out of jail since the age of 17. Her stories are full of love. There are smiles and laughter at times in some of the memories that she shares with me. Initially, I'm very confused. While I don't know what exactly brought her to jail, she seems so human. Not the deserving bad person that I was taught frequents our justice system. At one point, Miss Ashby expresses great concern about being able to go to the funeral. I can completely relate to all of these feelings. It is as if Miss Ashby and I are really not that different. As I said my goodbyes to Miss Ashby and I walked back to the chaplain's office, I was very heavy-hearted. I think psychologists call this moment cognitive dissonance. It's a time in our lives, you may have experienced it too, where our lived experiences are at odds with our own internal beliefs, or in my case, my early childhood development. As I tried to make sense of all of these experiences, my heart was literally on fire. Okay, maybe figuratively. I needed to know more about Miss Ashby and what exactly brought her there. So unlike my typical practice, I went into the inmate database and I looked up the arrest records associated with her name. Her familiarity with our county jail began when she was 17, juvenile, 18 in the jail itself, and she was arrested for stealing a 3-pack of women's underwear from Walmart. After that, Miss Ashby's rap sheet skyrockets in terms only of the number of arrests for the past 17 years. None of her crimes were what I would consider violent, and all of them are what I have come to categorize as crimes of survival. Seeing her in a moment of realness, the recognition of the loss of her grandmother, it compelled me to understand what brought her here and maybe why. My impulse to know is related really to a bigger question about our justice system as a whole. Right now, most of our state and federal incarceration systems operate under the concept of retribution or punitive payback. This focus is why my father taught me that people must be punished for their crimes, as it uses our justice system to answer questions specifically like, what law did they break? Who broke it? What do they deserve for breaking it? This punitive structure is focused mostly on the perpetrator of the crime and often uses the defendant as a tool to grant conviction. The community seems to not even be a factor in many of these cases. In trying to further my understanding and to satisfy the dissonance I was experiencing, I found out through research that there are alternatives to this approach. One such alternative is a practice called restorative justice. This mirrors some First Nations of North America and as well as the Indigenous peoples of Australia's justice practices. Through it, the act of justice is refocused from a punishment center to a restoration center, restoring the brokenness of the relationship back to wholeness. Unlike retributive justice, restorative justice attempts to answer questions like, what exactly happened? Who were all of the affected parties and why? And what should be done to try to repair the actual harm? The commonality in many models of restorative justice is the equal focus on the victim, the offender, and the community in which the offense was perpetrated. It is a voluntary and holistic approach aimed at truly righting the wrong. This type of justice seeking feels morally reparative to me. It seems to fit well within my own personal theology of the human soul. As a Unitarian Universalist, I believe that all of us contain a spark of divine. That is, we are born holy and complete, eternally loved. Miss Ashby didn't have a restorative justice option available to her. Instead, she was branded a criminal for stealing underwear and served punitive time in incarceration. Had her initial crime been responded to through the lens of restorative justice, a meeting between the owners of the store, Miss Ashby, and the community representatives would have been convened and facilitated to attempt to repair the actual harm. Can you imagine if this had happened? Perhaps all involved would have seen that Miss Ashby stole the underwear only because the money she received from her mandated sex work from her own mother was used to pay for rent, leaving her nothing for clothing. The community representatives and the store owner would have had the opportunity to see with empathy and try to understand the choices that led Miss Ashby to the behavior that damaged the relationship. Similarly, Miss Ashby would be asked to understand the economic harm she did to the store owners, and collaboratively, just maybe, the team would have worked toward reparations and satisfied all parties involved. Healing may have been possible without sending Miss Ashley into a system that seems to dehumanize and demean. An embodiment of my childhood understanding that if you find yourself in jail or I find myself there, there's something in our core that deserves to be there. For me, restorative justice has underscored a truth that continues to help me navigate my own work with incarcerated members. This truth being that there is an absolute and clearly identifiable difference between personhood and behavior. This has been a passion of mine since starting my ministerial work with the Worthy Now Prison Network at our largest congregation, the Church of the Larger Fellowship. Working with the over 1,065 incarcerated Unitarian Universalists, mind you, for the past year has been incredibly rewarding. They have taught me the power of this religious faith. The truths that I have learned are directly applicable, not just to my own life, but to our collective lives, even at brick-and-mortar churches like your own. One of the most important truths has been the learning that it is completely possible to acknowledge behaviors that harm us without demonizing the person who perpetrates the injustice. Amen. Oh, an amen. In the case of Miss Ashby, I can fully see her personhood as a beautiful spark of the divine that is simply trying to find her place in this mixed up world, just like all of us. Her past has led her to understand that some behaviors are acceptable for her in order to survive. I recognize that this path, the path of restorative justice, of yes, maybe forgiveness, is laden with massive emotional and spiritual work and is sometimes very long due to the heinousness of the crime. And yet, ever as a universalist, I cling to the hope for a better day. The kind of day echoed in our opening hymn, Si famanda la cosi, Wokunge sabi, si famanda nakosi, si yawa dinga. God, give us power to break the prisons. God, give us power to forgive and be forgiven. As I packed my bag at the end of my day with Miss Ashby and made my way out of the secured area of the jail, I couldn't help but reflect on our Unitarian Universalist value that all of us are worthy of love and acceptance. I no longer believe people deserve what they get in the punitive system of justice that we currently use. I believe that there has to be a better way. It may look like restorative justice, where the hurtful behaviors in life are righted while honoring and preserving the inherent worth of the offender. What would our justice system, our congregations, or even our entire denomination look like if all of our wrongs were mitigated using the tools of restorative justice? What if we used this in our own personal relationships as well? What if it was the solution for family conflicts or wrongs perpetrated in your family's school system? What do you imagine your response would be to Miss Ashby if you were the store owner in a restorative justice meeting? Could you hold her accountable for her bad behavior while remembering and honoring her inherent worth as a person? What if you were Miss Ashby? In the reparations, would you be able to remember your own eternal love? I really appreciate being here today, and I want to invite those of you who feel comfortable to come forward, and I have strips of paper in the front with markers. Again, I serve over 1,000 Unitarian Universalists who find themselves in our prison industrial complex in the United States all over. And part of that serving means that I send lots of letters every week, maybe 50 to 60 a week. And I would love to have little messages of hope or encouragement if you feel so inclined. So while we have our music for reflection playing, if you do feel that this is a ritual that you would like to partake in, please come forward, write a small note of encouragement, leave it on the table, and I will make sure to pick them up and package them with random letters that I use for the rest of the year. Thank you.